degrees in Boston.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The retired senator, Edward W. Brooke, had every reason to live the retiring life of a gentleman farmer in Warrenton, Virginia. At age 83, the man had already accomplished more in life than most of us ever will. His work as Massachusetts Attorney General earned him so much credit that the state named a new courthouse after him and went on to become the first African-American elected by popular vote to the U.S. Senate. People still talk about the Brooke Amendment. It's a rule that means people living in public housing will never have to pay more than 25% of their income on rent. But 25 years after he left the Senate, Edward Brooke is back. He's back with news about his own surprise encounter with breast cancer and a warning for men who, far more often than women, ignore the signs of illness and take a sort of macho approach to the body's danger signals. Connection listeners, men avoid seeing their doctors, and they often don't tell their partners, let alone their children or their friends, about their aches and pains. So why is that? And what are the implications for men and for their families, even for medical research, of that male, stiff, upper lip approach to illness? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're joined today by the former Senator Edward Brooke. He's in a studio in Washington. Welcome, Senator.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me and giving me this opportunity to talk about a subject that is very important in my life, but more importantly, important in the lives of all of our male population.
I gather you've been on something of a media merry-go-round over the last two or three days. Is that right?
Well, I never expected this firestorm, but yes, I have. I've done a lot of shows and talked to a lot of people and given several interviews because I am concerned. I'm concerned about the fact that there are 1,500 men get male breast cancer in a year, and about of that 1,500, 400 will die from cancer. Now, that's very small when you compare it with women's breast cancer. Female breast cancer, you know, there are thousands of women, unfortunately, who get breast cancer. And about 40,000 women will die from that breast cancer. But that doesn't mean it's not important that males understand that breast cancer is not exclusively a woman's disease, that men have breast tissue, and therefore they can have breast cancer, and they do. Awesome. I'm a man. I have breast cancer. And I hope that men will realize this, that there'll be a national awareness that men can have breast cancer, that doctors, particularly the family doctor, when they give examinations of men, that they examine their breasts. I had never in my life had a doctor examine my breasts until 2002 when it was discovered that I had breast cancer.
Can I ask now, you, Senator, to go back,
yes,
though? I mean, because it was actually two and a half years before you saw the doctor when you first noticed that there was some twinge of pain.
I didn't know it was cancer.
Right.
You're right. It was in 2000 I began to have this discomfort, I would call it, sometimes pain, slight pain, nothing that was unbearable.
What'd you think it was?
But I'd say to myself, it's a gas pain, it's a muscle pain, you know, never dreaming of cancer, never thinking about cancer.
So when did it first occur to you or your wife or somebody that maybe it was something more than a muscle pull?
Well, it was in September of 2002 that I awakened one morning and I had a more definitive pain. It was right in my right breast under my right nipple. And I told my wife, and she came over and she felt it and examined both breasts. And she said, I feel a very hard lump and I think you should see a doctor. But again, I said to her, oh, Anne, you don't worry. This is nothing. It'll pass. It's a muscle pain. And then a few days later, I was in the garden digging out stalks and whatnot, and I had a severe pain in my right rib cage. And I told her about it, and she said, well, will you see a doctor now? And I said, well, I guess I'll have to do it. So I went to see the doctor, told him about my right ridge cave. He took my x-rays of it, gave a blood test and all the rest, the routine things. I put on my shirt. I was on my way out the door, and I said to him, Dr. Gravett, I said, you know, Ann has told me that she felt a lump in my right breast. He said, come back in here, take off your shirt. He examined me, and right away he said, I'm sending you to Fauquier Hospital, which is our hospital in Warrington, and I'm sending you to the hospital for a mammogram. I said, a mammogram? Come on, Trice, a mammogram? What are you talking about? I don't have mammograms. He said, well, I'm going to have you have a mammogram. I went, got the mammogram. The mammogram sent me to get a sonogram. The sonogram then came back showing the lump under my nipple. I still, you know, I was concerned, yes, but I still didn't think it was cancerous. He said, well, the only way for us to find out is to do a test on it. And they did what they said, hardcore needle biopsy, where they put the needle into your breast, into the tumor, and they bring out little pieces of the tissue, very minute, send it to the pathology lab to find out whether it's malignant or benign. They did this, and that was very painful, and the surgeon who did it said, oh, I'll only do three times going in. Then after the third time, he said, well, one more. Then when he got to one more up to the tenth time, I said, I can't believe this. He said, well, I want to be sure. I want to get enough tissue for them to look at. They looked at the tissue. They found out that it was malignant. And then I knew certain things had to be done. I immediately told my wife, who cried, and I put my arms around her and said, look, I have breast cancer, but listen, it's going to be all right. And I believed it was going to be all right. And then I called Dr. LaSalle Fall, who's a dear friend and an eminent surgeon in cancer surgeon, and the Charles Drew professor at Howard University in Washington, D.C. And I told him, and I said, I've got breast cancer. I'm devastated. I'm not devastated, I said, really, but I am shocked. I thought it was rare. He said, well, I'm sorry to hear this, Ed, but I wouldn't say rare. I would say it's uncommon, but it's on the increase. And he said, and unfortunately, many men die from it, and particularly those deaths are high. There's a high rate among African-American males. So he recommended a doctor to do the surgery. I had it done here at George Washington University Medical Center.
Did you tell people about it at that time? Did you tell your friends and neighbors?
No, indeed. I went through the surgery, and even all the people who worked on me were women. When I went in the operation room, there were seven women. I was the only man. My doctor was a brilliant young breast care surgeon. And I had gone to their center before, but everything in it was pink and purple, and all the artifacts were feminine, all the paintings and everything else. And it was filled with women. When I walked in with my wife, I'm sure everyone there thought I was bringing my wife in for treatment rather than the other way around. But I got through that, got through the surgery, and then there was a painful recuperation period because they had to put drains on the left side, on the right side, two drains, and I had undergone what they call a dual modified mastectomy.
So they took a lot of tissue out of both sides of both breasts.
Yes, they took most of the tissue came from the right side. They took the tissue out of the left side because they wanted to be sure and prevent, and you know, they were being cautious about that, and for symmetry purposes. When they took the lump out, I'm still on the operating table. They sent that, of course, to the pathologist, but they knew that that was malignant. But they had also mapped where my sentinel lymph nodes were. So they took out the two sentinel lymph nodes, and they were positive, meaning they were malignant. So that extended the operation from 4 hours to maybe 6 hours. And then they proceeded there not to take any chances. They took out all of my axillary lymph nodes, which numbered 13. So the total number of lymph nodes that were taken out of my lymphatic system were 15 lymph nodes. Now, had my wife not found that lump, and obviously something had been going on for a period of time, had she not found that lump, which the cancer had already spread from that lump to the lymph nodes, it could have gone to the lymph nodes, it could have gone to the bone,
right.
It could have gone to the liver, and who knows where else.
How is your health now, Senator?
I think it's good. I'm on a medicine called tamoxifen. My oncologist, Dr. Siegel, here at the George Washington Hospital is eminent in the field, and he recommended that I not take chemotherapy and radiation. He thought that since this was an estrogen problem, a hormone problem, that I should take tamoxifen, which prevents the estrogen-fed cells, and also Coumadin for blood clotting, which is a side effect of the medication tamoxifen.
Senator, do you know now why it was back at the time of the operation and even in the months afterwards you were reluctant to tell people about this?
Well, you know, even though I've had a public life and a very fulfilling public life, I've always basically been a private person. Family matters, health matters, I've always kept to myself. And I've always shared my joys, but not my burdens. And I didn't want anybody to be burdened with it. I wrote my friends and said, look, don't send me any candy and cards and flowers and calls. You know, I'm going to be all right. And I didn't tell anybody about it. My wife didn't tell anybody about it. The hospital was very, very professional.
But something changed. Something changed that made you want to speak out.
Well, when I got all the data, and there's not a lot of data, I shouldn't say all the data, because there's just so little data on male breast cancer. But when I found out that men were dying from it, that there was no national male breast cancer awareness program, getting back to people in poverty who have no health care insurance. I'm one of the lucky ones. I had health insurance, and that paid for my operations and et cetera. But think of the men out there who don't have that, don't have health insurance, have no access to good medical treatment. Those men could be getting breast cancer and never knowing it, and as I would have never known it, and that cancer could have spread from their breast to other parts of their organ, and they may have died from cancer of the bone or cancer of the liver or cancer of something else, but they never knew. And if they knew, they didn't want to admit that they had breast cancer. To them, it's still an exclusive woman's disease.
Senator, I'm going to stop you there. We have to take a very short break. We'll come back and continue the conversation. Connection listeners, we're talking with retired Senator Edward Brooke about his surprise bout with breast cancer and why men suffer silently with their health concerns. Is it just that men are so macho when it comes to aches and pains? Why is that? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking this hour with former Senator Edward Brooke about his breast cancer and about the way that men tend to deny their health problems. We're joined now by Dr. Martin Miner. He's an assistant clinical professor of family medicine at Brown University School of Medicine in Providence, Rhode Island. And Connection listeners, if you want to get in on the conversation, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Dr. Miner, you've been sitting here in the studio with me listening to Senator Brooke talk about those rough decisions that he had to make over the past, well, I guess almost 2.5-3 years now.
That's correct. Good morning, Senator Brooke.
Good morning, Dr. Miner.
Good morning, Dick. What struck me about what you said is that there were a couple barriers that prevented you from going to the doctor. The first one was that it just didn't go away. And I find that to be true in many men. I don't know if that's been your behavior in the past. When you have a cough or different types of pain, did you make it a practice of going to the physician early on?
I had annual examinations, Dr. Martin. When I experienced these pains and discomfort, I just sort of minimized. I really thought it was gas pains and muscle, right, because it wasn't that clearly defined in my mind at that time. Not that I was avoiding anything. I just never suspected and never believed. Right. I said, hey, breast cancer, me? No, not possible. You know, right, just dismissed it.
I have to be honest with you. I'm a family practitioner, and I see between 28 and 32 patients a day on average. And I don't perform routinely male breast exams. I think there's a real need for that kind of educational effort.
Amen. I'm so happy to hear you say that, because I'm 83 years old. I have never had my breast examined by a doctor before in 2002. And I was born in 1919.
Right.
And I don't think most doctors examine men's breasts. They put a stethoscope in my chest and my back, of course. I go through that every year. But to actually put their hands on my breasts, I've never had that happen. And I suspect, as you have said and verified, that most doctors, you know, the primary care doctor, the family physician, does not examine a man's breasts. And therefore would have no way of knowing. And I don't think wives examine men's breasts as well. And I would be hopeful that wives and sweethearts and partners would examine those who have access to the chest of a man, would examine those breasts. That's a simple matter to do that. Like if my wife hadn't done it, they would never found the lump.
That's right. And the doctor would never have done it unless you pointed out, as you did, that I found a lump leaving the room. That was key. But there's also an issue here, and that's that men really don't know how to use the medical system or shy away from it, much more so than women. And I think you know that men die on average 6 to 7 years earlier than women. Men have a higher rate of accidental death and, as you said, breast cancer, and also, of course, heart disease and diabetes. And this is especially prevalent in African-American males. And
you're saying people, men have a general disinclination to go to the doctor whenever there's any kind of...
For any reason,
yes.
I think you're right, Dick. For any reason, they don't want to go to the doctor. That's the last resort for a man. It is.
You said yourself that, I guess I'll have to do it, which said to me that, you know, it's not one of the most pleasant experiences that you cherish, yet I imagine you have a very good relationship with your doctor. Because you felt comfortable.
A very personal relationship.
Sharing that with him.
Dr. Miner, what's behind that? Why is it that men are that much more reluctant to go to the doctor?
I believe that, Dick, that men focus on their accomplishments. They perceive their stead in life to be providers for their spouses or partners and their children. And as the senator has pointed out, they don't want to be a burden to their families. They tend to be private.
But let me turn it around. A mother is every bit a provider or a nurturer for her children, but the mother's much more likely to go to see the doctor if there's something wrong, no?
Right. Well, mothers have had experience with the medical profession early on through their childbearing years.
Right.
They're more comfortable being advocates for both themselves and their children. They make all the well child visits for their children. They make their prenatal visits. And men from adolescence until their 40s or 50s tend not to make that visit unless As the senator's pointed out, something just doesn't go away, whether it's a pain or a cough, and it usually has to last, I find, several weeks.
But doctor, also, and Dick, I'm sure you're aware of this, that women go annually, women who have health care insurance, of course, go annually for a mammogram at certain age, and they continue to do that. They see their gynecologist once a year, sometimes 6 months in a year. And men never. We don't go for prostate examination or any of those things in the course of a year. We don't have anything comparable to a gynecological examination. Men just don't do that. So I think there's a population out there that's just being overlooked. And I don't think it's racial or anything. I think some of it's poverty. Some of it's people who don't speak, like Hispanics, who still don't speak English and can't convey to American doctors sometimes what their feelings are. Asians, a lot of those people. But even in Caucasian males, they don't go to the doctors.
Let's test the waters with this. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We've got a call from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Joanne's on the line. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. Thanks. Can you hear me okay? I'm on the cell phone.
Yes, you're fine. Go ahead.
I love the show. I agree with this, what the senator says, and also with what the doctor says. My husband will be 50 this year. We've been together nearly 10 years, and he never goes to the doctor. He can have a fever. He's had a couple fevers, really, really been ill. And in the instance we've known him, thankfully he's in good health most of the time. He resists going to the doctor for anything.
Why, Joanne?
His mother is a cancer survivor with colon cancer. His sister, who is 5 years younger than him, has had three colonoscopies at her doctor's advice, knowing that one of the parents had a colon cancer incident. He refuses to have a colonoscopy. He needs glasses. Won't go get his eyes tested. I mean, anything.
I'm sitting here going, why?
Well, he has a fear. I've tried to nail this down. This is actually the only thing we argue about. We have a good relationship, but we argue about this all the time because, as the senator was saying, women do go annually for a pap smear. When we're pregnant, we have to go all the time. We're in tune with our bodies because we menstruate monthly. We take the kids for their shots. We deal with the flus and the ear infections. We're in the doctor's office a lot, so we have a comfort level. He never goes to the doctor, ever. I think the last time he went was about 5-6 years ago. And it was for a really small little thing that he had to get taken care of. We got, it was something really minor, and he was in and out of there. He won't have a physical.
I know of a case where a man has a PSA of 48. Can you imagine that? I heard before that he had 39. Now he is 48. He will not go to see a doctor.
Yeah. And the normal is four.
My dad had prostate cancer, and he was similar to my husband.
Let me interrupt you, because
he never got his PSA.
I need to know the number we're talking about here. The PSA we're talking about is a measure of prostate.
Prostate screening antigen test. It's used for screening for prostate cancer. Normal is between 0 and 4. So 48 is very high and very likely to suggest a malignancy.
And I get
one of those PSAs every year. I'm very careful about my PSA. Thank goodness, Dr. Marner is 1.3, so that's pretty safe in that department. But I didn't have a PSA for my breast.
Joanne, what you highlight a very common scenario in my office, which is that the wife or the partner of the man often makes the appointment for the man.
And I tried that. He doesn't go. He won't go. My mother had breast cancer, and it was only after my mother's breast cancer that my dad had his PSA tested, and he did have prostate cancer.
Would he allow you to touch his breast or examine his breast?
No, he would not. No.
He would not.
No. And he won't have a PSA test done either, and he will be 50. His birthday is this year, 50. And I just can't do anything about it.
I think men feel their bodies are something like a car, that if there's no knock or ping or if there's not... black oil coming out.
If it's not broken, don't fix it.
I think even worse, Dick, I think they feel they're invincible.
I wonder.
But they're not.
I do. But they do have, Joanne, they do have what I call teachable moments. They do come in at certain times in their life or feel more vulnerable. And those times usually occur at the birth of a child when they're getting life insurance for the first time. Or with the illness of a coworker might have a heart attack and and a man will come in and say, you know, I think I need screening. I think I don't want to have that happen to me. Or when a parent dies, those are times that I find that men are more receptive to coming in. And I think what's key is that men establish a relationship with a healthcare provider that they trust, as the senator did. Because once you do, you realize that it's not this terrible thing. It's like I've always perceived going to the dentist. I've always had this fear. Yet once I went, it wasn't so horrible. And we have to understand.
You know, men don't like to make out all the forms that are required in the doctor's office or at the hospital.
I skip those forms for them, and I take my own histories when I talk to them.
Well, that's very good. But most places, you know, you go, you got to make out those forms. I think a lot of men don't want to be bothered with that.
Or
they'll take their wives and let their wives fill out the forms for them.
You're right.
Did something change in your mind? Did you hit, I'm going to use the fear word here, did you hit that sort of moment where you feared that what was wrong with you might kill you? And I'm wondering whether or not that's a part of your decision to say, this is more than just about me. By using my profile, by speaking out, maybe I can get other men to think about the fear word.
And you know, Dick, I never feared or thought that I was going to die from cancer, because there's plenty of time for that, but I never thought about that. I have great faith. I had a wonderful wife and a wonderful supporter. And I went in it, I think, with the right attitude. I thought if I did have it, and I did when I found out I did, that they would take it out, and that either I'd take chemotherapy and radiation or something else, and that I would be cancer-free. My great fear was when I began to look into more research about male breast cancer, and that's when I became alarmed to find out that insurance companies won't pay for men's mammograms, for example, if that's the fact, that men don't examine themselves routinely. I never myself examined my breasts. And the wives don't examine men, or men won't let their wives examine their breasts, or their partners examine their breasts. But it just seems to me that we've got to expand our research into male breast cancer. I don't think we know enough about it yet. I think we know the basics, Dr. Miner, but I don't think we know what's out there, how many people are being treated, the whole question of poverty and health care for this whole country. You know, I hear that in Japan and other places that it's increasing much more rapidly than it is in the United States. And that's why I reached out to the Susan G. Komen Breast Care Foundation and worked with them to getting this message out. I certainly didn't want to give up my privacy. I still don't want to give up my privacy. But I thought that if it could help save a life, or it could make this awareness, and I speak, as Dr. Miner said earlier, I speak to the medical profession. It doesn't take them that much time to actually examine a man's breast. And if they find something suspicious, then they ought to be able to send it, that patient, to get a mammogram for which the insurance should pay. Now, that may be oversimplification, Doctor. What do you think? But that's what I think as a layman.
I agree with you completely. I think it's broader than simply just breast cancer, because we have, as you pointed out, fewer men have health insurance than women. And part of that's federally mandated. Medicare covers women and children, but it doesn't generally Medicaid covers women and children, but it doesn't generally cover men. And Medicare does not cover preventative services. So if you want to get, for example, a bone density screening, as men age, they're more susceptible to fractures, just as women. And you can't get a DEXA scan, which is a test to determine bone density, in men because it's not covered. Even
those is this changing, men, though? I mean, it's
not changing. In fact, it's getting a bit worse.
More restrictive, fewer things.
Exactly.
Being allowed. Let's go back to our lines now. 1-800-423-8255. Frank's joining us now from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Frank.
Hi. as important as everything has been so far about the tendency of men not to seek medical help,
yeah,
I'm interested in the fact that there is a significantly greater problem for men dealing with breast cancer. From a cultural standpoint, breasts sure seem to be a gender definition point for women. Is it possible that one of the problems men have with the whole concept of having breast cancer is that they don't see themselves as having breasts?
I think it's part of it, if I might add, answer your question. Men I've talked to, they don't think they have breasts. They say, we have a chest. We don't have breasts. Even though they have breast tissue, they will not admit to themselves or anyone else that they have breasts. No man stands up and says, I have breasts. I have a chest.
Well,
now, my chest was never flat. I always wanted a flat chest. It was larger, not greatly larger, but larger than normal, I think, for a male. And even when they wanted to do reconstruction and put back my right breast, I said to them, look, I've gone all these years not wanting a breast, and now I'm certainly not going to restructure a breast that I didn't want in the first place. But that's the way men feel about it. They don't have breasts. And the fact is, they do.
I agree with you, Senator. I think that also that it's part of it's tied into our masculinity that not only don't we have breasts, but we don't have sickness or illness, and because sickness and illness, of course, would prevent us from working and providing, and also, of course, we don't have time to go and during the day to the physician's offices. They're open from 9 to 5.
Or we choose not
or
to.
Or we choose not make to time. Make time.
In our day, absolutely. 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we invite you in on a conversation with Senator Edward Brook and Dr. Martin Miner. And we're talking about the ways that men stay silent about their health problems, ideas behind why that is the case. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, at...
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Men die younger than women. We know that. Some say it's because they visit the doctor less frequently and don't talk about their health problems. And we're talking this hour with Senator Edward Brook, diagnosed with breast cancer after 2 years of feeling pain and ignoring it. Also with me in the studio, Dr. Martin Miner, who happens to be in Boston today, Dr. Miner, because you're taking part in a conference where doctors are sitting around talking about men's health. What's happening in the professional side here?
But this is a rapidly advancing field that was identified in 2000 by the Commonwealth study out of New York, that all the issues that you raised earlier, that about men dying earlier than women, men going to the physician later, men not seeking primary care. And today we, as part of the Massachusetts Medical Society, are having the first men's health symposium to address these barriers about what prevents men from obtaining that care, both on an emotional level and a federal level and monetary level. But it's key to understand that this relationship between the male patient and the physician needs to be nurtured from early on. Then it needs to be nurtured in adolescence, and it needs to be continued from adolescence into the 20s and 30s and 40s throughout the time. And they need to feel as comfortable as women, as we've mentioned earlier, mm-hmm, in seeking care so they can raise these issues. And I find that once I break down some of those barriers by perhaps letting men feel more in control during the exam. If they don't want a colonoscopy this year, I'm not dogmatic. I don't say, you have to have it. I say, okay, next year we'll try again. If I give them a little bit more control and talk to them about diet and exercise and their sexual function and other matters of interest to them, then they are bonded to you for life. They may change insurers, but they don't change doctors.
All right. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Christopher now, who's calling in from Boston. Hi, Christopher.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a clinical psychologist. I work in a cancer survivor clinic at the Dana-Farber in Boston. I have really two comments. One is that I think what Senator Brooke's story and the discussion you're having really touches upon but maybe hasn't addressed is that I think progress in access to health care, whether it's men, whether it's breast cancer, other diseases, Alzheimer's, is really impeded in our country by lack of a national health care system. And I think that it limits our ability to help many underserved groups that have problems with access because we don't have a comprehensive system. I guess my second comment really has to do with the origin of men's reluctance to seek care. I think we've been talking really about the problem in adult men, but I think the problem originates in the way that we socialize and raise boys to think about their bodies and their emotional life. I think when little boys hurt themselves, fall down, get cuts and scrapes, we don't say to them, gee, that must hurt. Let me take you out of the game, clean you up, see how you feel. We say to them, buck up, you're okay. And I think that that teaches them that their internal experience, whether it's physical or psychological, is something that's not really worth thinking about. And they grow up not knowing how they feel inside.
What do you think, Senator? When the going gets tough, the tough get going. We all know the slogans, play through the pain, suck it up.
I think the call is absolutely right. You say, get back in there, get back in there. You know, if he hits you, hit him back. You know, don't take anything off of anybody. You grow up with that kind of admonition, that kind of warning, that kind of suggestion from your parents. I think what has been said is wonderful. I think Dr. Miner's statement about what they are looking at now about general men's health is so important. And as the caller said, a national health plan. We just don't have that. We've got to get to that. We've got to move to that without question. But I'm encouraged. I think I see on the horizon the beginning of this kind of awareness. I hope we can continue it. I'm very pleased that organizations have come up like the Susan G. Komen Foundation, which basically works with women, but now has expanded to work with male breast cancer as well, and they're getting into research in that area. The Why Me Foundation, which is a national cancer foundation as well, is doing the same sort of thing. I think the Congress, to get back, of course, to a national health care plan, which we all know we need and hope we can take away money from wars and all the other problems and put it into health care. We need it, and we need it desperately, and I hope we'll do that. And I hope the Congress will also be aware of the fact that there has been precious little money that has been spent in research on male health cancer.
You know, a lot of what we're talking about today, though, as Dr. Miner says, as Christopher is saying, comes down to the way that a parent talks to a child, the way that a doctor talks to a patient. And I wonder, Christopher, if I could just go back to you and ask you a question as a psychologist.
Sure.
What do you change? Do you tell, you know, the kid on the baseball team or the football team that if you've got a scrape, you've got to come out? I mean, give us something we can work with here.
I think there's two issues. I think one is how do you approach the adult male patient who isn't perhaps taking care of themselves? I think it's tempting to think that these men are sitting home aware of how they feel, you know, worried, oh my gosh, I might have this or that, and not expressing it. I think one of the problems often is these patients is they really don't know how they feel physically or psychologically, and part of it is getting them to tune in to some of those feelings, you know, maybe for the first time in years. I think with, you know, the broader, more sort of social and cultural issue around raising children, particularly raising boys, I think is something that, you know, holds much more promise for the future. I think that as parents, we need to, you know, think about how we talk to our children. I think as educators, I think as people who are, you know, responsible for children in different settings, teachers, et cetera, I think we also have to look at our culture, at our media. You know, what do we value? Do we value the player who, you know, plays through the broken ankle? Or do we say, God, that, you know, that's crazy. He's going to need that ankle. You know, that's part of him. That we value people who learn to take care of their bodies, not value people who learn to abuse them.
All right, Christopher, thanks for your call. I want to shoot straight across to Bird's Eye, Indiana. Now Steve's on the line. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
So, have you got a fix for this?
I wish. I really do feel that men, especially in lower socioeconomic groups, are very negatively influenced to go visit doctors.
By who, Steve? I mean, who tells a blue-collar working man that you know, going to the doctor is a bad thing or a mark of being a wuss? Where does that come from?
A lot of that is the old macho image. You have to defend the territory from intruders and whatnot. It's a lot of the old hand-me-downs from our primate ancestors. But a lot of that, you know, we've developed culture and whatnot in the last 40,000 years, but we haven't evolved quite that much physically yet. But there's a definite economic disadvantage to go see a doctor because you lose time at work, you lose money there, in addition to receiving a fairly hefty doctor's bill.
But isn't that just the same with women, Steve, or no?
Women have the option, if they don't wish to work, they can simply remain at home, and then the man will support them whether he likes it or not, because the courts have a severe bias toward women and against men when it comes to family court or divorce court.
Dr. Miner, could you...
Steve, I just have a question for you.
Yes,
men, you don't feel that way about your car, though. You'll take your car in for its maintenance checks at 30,000 miles, 60,000 miles, and most men do that. But what is it about going to the doctor that you think that prevents men from doing the same when they're 50 coming in for that battery of tests that could save their lives, including colon cancer and heart disease?
I can't speak for all men, but I can speak for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised that, you know, touching is usually not really that good a thing. You're going to, usually about the only time you get touched is if you're going to get smacked for doing something wrong. And a lot of the men, especially poorer ones, are raised in that fashion still. Mm-hmm. That's one of the, as you lose various types of benefits to withhold from children for control purposes, more and more physical punishment becomes a control factor.
So you're saying that touching by a male physician in the office is a barrier for you or for others?
I feel for myself, it is. I'm aware of that, and I just, mm-hmm. you know, that's part of it. You have to deal with that.
Right.
But at the same time, it's embarrassed. I feel myself now. I'm very embarrassed talking about it.
Right.
But
right.
That I'm sure that plays into that too. And it's just the way many of us were brought up.
You know, we started this program by listening to the senator tell his story about his breasts. And I'm sitting here in the studio thinking every time, Senator, that you said the word breasts, that couldn't we just replace the word with chest? I mean, a caller mentioned it. But I'm wondering whether or not there wasn't a sort of moment where you went, okay, going to use the B word here, you know?
It never entered my mind. I never thought about it, to be honest with you, Dick. I just didn't have the hang-ups about it. I knew that I had breasts. I knew I had breast tissue.
Yeah.
I was a pre-med student. Most people in my public don't realize that, but I was a pre-med student. I studied a little bit about it. I knew men had breast tissue, but it never entered my mind to be concerned about whether I had breasts or I had chest. And then, as I said earlier, I had mostly breasts than chest.
Mm-hmm.
And that was never a happy situation.
Let me turn to Dr. Miner with a question here about what the longer-term implications of this are. If men don't go to the doctors and talk about what's wrong with them, does that mean that the medical community, therefore, has less information about how to treat men. I mean, in a long roundabout way, is this part of the reason why men aren't routinely checked for breast cancer? Because perhaps the doctors don't have that base of medical research that women have provided them by their willingness to talk to their doctors.
Well, that's very true. The number of studies on male breast cancer are few, much fewer than the number of studies on female breast cancer. And also, that's not only due to prevalence, it's because that we don't talk about it. Men in general, and I think the previous caller pointed this out, we don't want to talk about anything with our genital urinary system, our GU system. So when he was alluding to, I think it's true, men feel discomfort when you're going to prepare yourself to do the rectal exam to check the prostate. And they go, oh, that's the thing I've been hating most, or I've been dreading the most. And, you know, we just have to kind of break those barriers that this is not personal. It is personal, but it's not, it shouldn't be a barrier to your care.
Is Steve, are you still there?
Yes, no, doctors.
No. Go ahead, Senator. I just wanted to say thanks to Steve.
I was just going to say doctors, of course, know that men can have breast cancer, but I think they put it way on the back burner. They don't think about it in their examination. They're aware of it, but they do nothing about it. So even those who are fortunate to have health care, they don't get examined for their breasts. And I think that if we don't expand our research, as Dr. Martin said, there's precious little data on male breast cancer. I tried to find everything I could about it when I got it myself. I tried to find there's not much out there that you can really depend upon and rely upon. And I think we're going to have to do that so that men know it, and doctors know it, and we can get on with still looking for the cure, but certainly for early detection and treatment. That's what I'm hoping we will be able to do.
Well, Senator, there may be a little bit more information thanks to you and others who choose to speak out about it. Thanks for being on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me, Dick, and thank Dr. Martin, Chris, and the callers. It's a wonderful opportunity to at least get the message out.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been an honor to be here.
Senator Edward Brook, former Republican senator from Massachusetts, and Dr. Martin Miner, family practitioner and assistant clinical professor of family medicine at Brown University School of Medicine. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. Coming up next here on WBUR, Here and Now, with the news of the day, and Car Talk's Ray Maliazzi concocting a recipe for lobster pasta. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, offering degree and certificate programs and studies in violence. Open house June 20th at 5:30. bgsp.edu.